All You Need Is Love. It's titled All You Need Is Love for a couple reasons. First, the cheekiest reason is that our esteemed rector, Jimmy Bartz, is out of town for a couple weeks, and for some reason, absolutely perplexing and unimaginable to me, Jimmy Bartz possesses a strong dislike of the Beatles. So this is kind of my version of While the Cat's Away, the Mice Will Play a little bit. But I also love the Beatles. I think that their lyrics and their music are theologically rich and resonant. And so what I want to do in this preaching series is to look at the work and the lives of the Fab Four in some respect as if it constituted a sacred text that I could exegete and extract some good news from to share with you, faithful followers of Jesus, looking to live out your faith in 2025. So in those three parts, I said last week that the first installment of All You Need Is Love is gonna focus on loving God and loving creation. This week, we'll focus on loving others, and next week, on loving ourselves. But really, when we think of it, those are kind of false and artificial distinctions, right? I mean, they're all intertwined and caught up together. The more you love God in creation, the more you'll love others. And you can't really love other people without loving yourself. I mean, those two things are so strongly correlated. But for today, I'm going to focus on this question primarily on how we love others well. And I want to do so by looking at the Beatles' life story a little bit more robustly and explicitly than I did last week. I want to look at the life of these four lads from Liverpool and see what they have to show us about living out this call to love others as faithfully as possible. So, the gospel according to the Beatles. Who knows about the Beatles' story of origin? Does anyone know when the moment was when Paul first met John? Public bus, that's a good guess. That's when that plays into our narrative in an important way. But John and Paul first met at a church picnic. Yes, indeed, at St. Peter's Church Fete in Woolton, which is a sleepy little suburb of Liverpool, on July 6, 1957. I Google image searched Woolton. It really is a sleepy little suburb. There wasn't much going on there. There's probably less going on there in 1957. And apparently the St. Peter's Church Fete, this party, this barbecue, was sort of like the big thing going on in that part of Liverpool on any given year. So it said that at this church fete, there were games of hoopla, which I didn't Google. I have no idea what hoopla is. But there were cake stalls. There were demonstrations by police dogs. And there was the crowning of the Rose Queen. You know who the Rose Queen was? She was the little girl with the best Sunday school attendance that year. There was also musical accompaniment, and the festivities started around 2 in the afternoon with two large lorries, flatbed trucks, climbing their way up this hill. The first lorry had the Rose Queen and her retinue installed, and the second had a group of young musicians called the Quarrymen, from the local Quarry Hills High School, fronted by none other than John Lennon. Paul McCartney, they're both 16 years old at the time, Paul McCartney shows up with one of his lads, and they're watching this performance, and Paul's impressed by the fact that as these quarrymen are trying to keep their footing, driving up this windy road, John decides to just dangle his legs over the side and strum his guitar and sing songs that he doesn't completely remember the lyrics to. And Paul's impressed by the fact that he introduces words about life in the penitentiary into his songs. And so Paul has this thought, you know, I wouldn't mind being in a group with this guy. He goes and introduces himself at the fete, and he recalls smelling John's old beery breath. and how he grew to love that old beery breath in time. So Paul and John strike up a conversation around their mutual love of music. They start playing with one another. And then Paul introduces John to a younger musician, someone who's in the year below him at school, who lives in his suburb of Liverpool, named George Harrison. Now, John thinks that George is too young to be in the group, so he kind of puts him off a couple times. And finally, on a city bus, Paul gets George another audition in front of John. John sees that he's got chops, so they put the band together. They find a drummer named Pete Best, and then they start playing around in like social clubs and dance halls around the Liverpool area. They meet this like quasi-professional, sort of unofficial tour manager who starts booking gigs for them. And then this guy, whose name is Alan Williams, gets the bright idea, because they can't book large clubs throughout England, to send them to Germany. So this guy, Alan Williams, sends them to Hamburg, Germany, where a very unenterprising entrepreneur has converted two houses of ill repute in the red light district to concert venues. And the Beatles get a residency in the red light district of Hamburg. They're there for a couple years, and they're playing these like relentless bills, where for 5 hours straight, they're having to go through their whole repertoire of original songs and covers, and then just to improvise on their own to fill the space and to fill the room for 5 hours. But playing together that rigorously and relentlessly for so long helps them develop a certain chemistry and a certain cohesion and a certain confidence in one another's creative powers, so that, and Ringo's joined the band by this time, when they come back to England, they're kind of untouchable. So they start playing gigs around Liverpool, and then a young promoter and manager named Brian Epstein hears them play. Brian is mostly into classical music, but he sort of hears the potential, so he pulls every string in the industry he can to try to get them auditions for different record companies in London. They play at these auditions, and they don't get many of them, and then he stays up late at night going through the mental Rolodex and finally gets them an audition in front of a guy named George Martin, who finally signs the Beatles on the condition that they take the song they brought in, Please Please Me, and up the tempo just a little bit, which of course becomes their first number one single. What does the story of the Beatles have to do with the life of spirituality? First of all, the Beatles are from this place called Liverpool, which is like a little bit of a backwater in the UK at the time. Liverpool used to be a great port city, but it was because of that fact it was sort of decimated over the course of the first two World Wars. Well, yeah, the first two, right? Hopefully the only two. And by the time the Beatles get together, there isn't much going on there. I mean, Liverpool was a long way from London. But they follow their sense of call. They follow their path. Hamburg's kind of the last place they want to play, but they've got this yes and mentality where they just say yes, stay curious about any possibility, and they develop this cohesion. If it wasn't for Hamburg, they would have never gotten their 10,000 hours. They never would have developed this unique chemistry and cohesion that allows them to flourish when they come back to the UK. Brian Epstein is a classical music guy. And if it's not for Epstein, we would have never had those strings and Eleanor Rigby or A Day in the Life. And George Martin, he's like so forward-thinking that he lets them create songs like Strawberry Fields Forever or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. It's a series of little happy accidents, of little possibilities that they stay open to that allows them to develop into what they will ultimately one day become. And that sort of posture of spirit, that curiosity and openness, That belief in the fact that there's something bigger that might be writing the story, and that there's something wiser within them than what they can calculate and intellectualize around, translates into their songwriting as well. You'll see on the back of your program, there is a QR code. And this QR code links to a brief excerpt from a wonderful documentary film that was created on the production of the Beatles' last studio album, Let It Be. And let yourselves be warned, this is total Beatles nerd stuff. It's a 7-hour documentary where what you see is basically the lads like trying to figure out how to write songs. They don't bring any demos in. They don't bring in many musical ideas. But it's a fly on the wall perspective of how genius works in real time. I mean, like Yoko is sort of attached to John the entire time, like whispering in his ear in this little conspiratory way. And there's even a moment like you can feel the tension when Paul's singing Let It Be, that beautiful hymn to his mother whose name was Mary, and John's kind of like mocking him in the background, thinking it's a cheesy production. But the moment that I want to draw your attention to is the moment that gives the documentary its name. The documentary is called Get Back. And the way this song gets created is absolutely awe-inspiring. Paul's sitting there strumming at his bass, and it's not plugged into an amplifier, and you can see he's just working it, trying to find a melody, and finally he starts to hum something like, thought she was a woman, but she was another man. It's kind of like a little mumble track, but he's finding a melody, and finally he kind of finds a little bit of a chorus, and Ringo's flat deadpan voice with like hardly any melodic ability in the background goes, get back, get back. And you see this song come into being in real time. But what's so beautiful about it, what's so beautiful about this moment is if you look at George and Ringo's faces, as Paul is driving at that melody, they just look bored. They look kind of annoyed, a little bit of frustrated. They've been in this recording studio for hours, and it's all like bizarrely lit with like 70s lighting, and they're just over it. And then finally, he finds something. Paul trusts himself to keep going. He trusts this process that hasn't let him down in the past, and he knows if he stays open and he stays curious, that that magic is going to happen. Okay, preacher. How do you tie the gospel according to the Beatles back to the gospel according to Luke and the life and witness and ministry of Jesus Christ? I've got to say that for someone trying to create a preaching series, the lectionary architects, the people, the powers that be that appoint the readings for any given Sunday, which, you know, we don't get to choose. They're just like assigned to us by like the bigger church people who put these resources together. These are like the least optimal readings possible to try to work around because they're all like downer Jesus just giving lectures to the scribes and the Pharisees and to his followers. And this one is like such a tough one to work with. You know, the translation we have sort of softens the message a little bit, but it actually, like in the original, it's like Jesus says to his disciples, if you don't hate your mom and dad and your siblings and your spouses, you can't follow me. You've got to hate your own life as well if you want to take up your cross and be my disciple. Okay, what does he mean by this? What do we make from this? I think Jesus could be speaking literally on some level. Maybe there are times that our loved ones and those with whom we're in relationship can hold us back from flourishing into our authentic destiny as human beings. But I think he's also speaking metaphorically. I think that mothers, fathers, spouses are these forces in the culture, these expectations that get put on us that sort of overdetermine our narratives of how we're supposed to live life. We don't do that type of thing in this family. In this family, we're all accountants. In this family, we're all musicians. We don't go to that kind of college. We don't hang out with those kind of people. Y'all, Jesus is the son of a carpenter. Jesus is from Bethlehem, which is kind of a place like Liverpool. I mean, this is a total backwater in the Roman Empire. Bethlehem is a long way from Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is a long way from Rome, the center of power and authority. Jesus is the son of a carpenter, but we see him constantly exploring this other sense of call, even from childhood. He's hanging out in the temple. He's asking the rabbis questions. And then when his public ministry starts to get going, he gives this great speech in front of all those gathered at the synagogue. And what happens? The crowd tries to throw him off a cliff. I mean, like, Jesus throughout his ministry is confronted by all these setbacks, by all these impediments. Every time he tries to preach, every time he tries to heal, the religious authorities, the political authorities, other people who are just jealous, try to put him down and stymie him. And as Jesus works out his ministry, it's kind of like the Beatles in Hamburg. He's like figuring it out, turning to his disciples, saying like, hey, y'all have left everything to follow me. Who do you say that I am? Who do you think I am? Who do I think I am? One of the prophets? Something more? And he just keeps saying yes. He lives into that sort of yes and following this sense of call that doesn't quite make sense to him, but yet he trusts. He trusts that there's something more going on than what he can understand intellectually. He stays curious. He has faith in God the Father and this kind of mystical reality, putting things into order. And he has faith in some wisdom, some intuition deep within. That kind of wisdom and intuition that guides an artist like Paul to create a song like Get Back. Okay, what does this all mean for us? What I think it means for us is a number of things. The first thing I would say is if you've ever felt like you're from a nowhere town, like you're from a backwater, you're from a Liverpool or a Bethlehem, God still might have amazing things in store for you. Each one of us is beautifully, wonderfully made in God's image, and each of us has a part to play in this great drama of healing and the elevation of creation that we're all called into being a part of. The next thing I would say is this idea of call, this idea of what it looks like to be in service of others. So Jesus, he gives this speech, and the culmination of it is, pick up your cross and follow me. And whenever we use that kind of language in the church traditionally, we usually hear it like kind of harshly in this like punitive tone where it's like, deny yourself joy, exercise a little bit more discipline, a little bit more asceticism, a little more self-denial so you can purify yourself and be good enough for this work that Jesus is trying to hand over to you. But I don't think that's the way to think about it at all. I think that Jesus, when he's inviting us to pick up our cross, is actually an invitation to liberation and an invitation to deeper joy. There's a thinker that I love, Carl Jung. I bring him up all the time in sermons, and he was Freud's old student. He was his like prize student, and then they break over the question of religion. And what Jung says about the imitation of Christ is he says, being an imitator of Christ doesn't mean we become an itinerant preacher and then go around preaching in a radical way until the powers that be put us to death. That's kind of like the St. Francis route, I guess, like just doing it in a very literal way. But Jung says to follow Jesus means being as true to our individual sense of calling and purpose and identity as Jesus was to his. So y'all, that's the invitation. And your calling, I don't want to give you the wrong impression of this. It doesn't have to be something grandiose. You don't have to write a hit song or start a British invasion. You don't have to revolutionize Christianity or reform a religious tradition like Judaism as Jesus did. Rather, it's just living a life fully lived. It's coming fully alive. Remember last week, that idea of at creation, the light of God gets dispersed throughout humanity, and that is what a life truly lived looks like, is going around and fanning into flame the goodness, truth, and beauty that's already there. And I would just say that if you want some like more concrete advice on how to get in touch with that, maybe that sense of call, that sense of purpose, that sense of drive, that sense of the muse or the Holy Spirit within, that there are a couple ways you can do it. I always love the thought of this guy, Frederick Buechner, a great writer who says, the place to which God calls us is where our deep joy and the world's deep hunger meet. Our deep joy meets the world's deep hunger. How do you find out what your joy is? Well, what lights you up? I mean, you can spend time actually in prayer asking God to help you see that. God, how can I live a life more fully alive? How can I get more in touch with a deeper joy? You can ask your loved ones, ask trusted friends, family members, call a priest, reach out to someone on the church staff. We'd love to have that conversation with you about what lights you up. And if you're not sure, we'll give you like all sorts of volunteer opportunities so you can find out. You can journal about it. You can go for a walk in nature, all these different ways to get in touch with that curiosity. What's something that fires me up, and what's something that the world really needs? What's something the community really needs? And here's a hint at how to determine whether you're receiving an authentic message from the Holy Spirit. It won't feel heavy. It won't feel severe or overburdening or laden with like a bunch of consequentiality. It'll feel light. It'll feel joyful. It'll feel beautiful. And there'll be an element of play, an element of fun. Last week after the 8 o'clock service, I met with a couple parishioners for our formation hour. And we started to talk about like what distinguishes the Beatles from other British invasion bands like the Stones. And one of the parishioners said something that I think was so profound. He said, the Beatles never lost their sense of innocence. And I kind of think that's true. I mean, even later in their career, when they were making use of mind-altering, let us say, compositional aids, they're still writing songs like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Strawberry Fields Forever, not like the Stones, Paint It Black. You know, they're still in touch with the joy of creating, of just getting into the studio and playing together and figuring it out. Even when things get tense, you can see it in that documentary. If you want to nerd out for 7 hours, you have the opportunity to. So this is what I would say, y'all. I mean, I think that that is part of the invitation. When you look at the Beatles, they're in touch with this sort of like almost Edenic innocence. That description we get in the book of Genesis of Adam and Eve walking with God in the cool of the evening breeze. They're tapping into that joy, that childlike delight, that childlike exuberance, that childlike curiosity and willingness to just give something a try, to fail when needed, and to engage their creativity just because it's fun to do. And y'all, that's what it looks like to tap into that deep joy, to be in service of this greater good that God is calling us into building together alongside one another here and now. So this week, and in every week ahead, tap into that childlike joy, that innocence, that play. Get back to Eden. Get back to that place where you know a sense of intimacy with God and where God sees you as beloved. Get back to that place of innocence, to that Eden. Get back, get back, get back to where you once belonged and to where you do belong and where you always will belong. Amen.